Okay, I think we're there. Guys, for your information, there is a sign there saying it's on air, meaning that we are actually streaming this, and for privacy reasons, I guess, I should inform you that the camera is back there, and at least some of you on the front seats here will, your back will be shown on the streaming, on the recording. So if you are that later, remember to sit on the back or whatever. because we have to stream this, we have to record it. It's like a pretty large class now, but it is a much larger class than this, because the course we are starting up now have students from several of the different master programs we have here. So there will be a few new faces around here. I don't even remember which master programs are present this year. I think at least it's interaction design. It's probably one or two different programs at information security, right? Experience-based and those who are more on full-time here on campus. There is probably possible to divide it even further in information security. Sustainable manufacturing, is that still the name of that course? So there are some, there are a few yeses here, meaning that quite a few of you as well. and I probably haven't mentioned all. There's probably a few more lines I haven't mentioned. Meaning there is a big class. Some of you will be able to be here present, some won't. Even though there are no more corona restrictions and changes based on this, that this course is still designed in a way to make it possible to follow from distance. I made a number of recordings, as you might have noticed, on the Blackboard page of the course. It should be possible to follow them there. But more on the structure now. I guess I have to present myself. That's a good start, isn't it? Frode Volden is my name. I employed at the Institute of Design. I'm not a designer or anything. I'm actually a psychologist of every all strange thing. Imagine here. But as psychologists, we have a focus on the scientific process, thinking in a scientific way. And I've been teaching classes like this and supervising master thesis, for instance, for the last 20 years or so. So I have some experience in this. Yes, as I said, we have a Blackboard page, and hopefully you have managed to go into that page now, and under coursework in the menu there, you will find 12, 14 recordings or something of different topics that we are going to go through. In addition to those recordings, we will have a few of these meetings as we are today, where I'm going to comment, give examples, do some more practical stuff that's linked to the different lectures that's in here. So that's the main thing. There is also a schedule now for these physical meetings that we're having. So you will find the dates for that under the menu item coursework in Blackboard. We're going to do something in addition to listening to this recordings and these meetings that we're having here, and that is to write a couple of small essays. I call them essays. It's short papers you're going to write on a couple of topics. One of them has to do with some basic terminology, variables, reliability, validity, stuff we are getting back to. And one is on plagiarism and how to work in science. So that is something you're going to do individually. In addition to that, we are going to do a project, or you're going to, in a more practical way, actually gather some data. It can be data on a, you'd say a relevant project for you, as based on your the study program you follow, or it can be something. That's up to you. The point is, we have to gather data in a structured way, and these data have to have different qualities, like some of them need to be continuous, some needs to be categorical, etc. And we are going to do analysis with those data using a statistical package for that. So we're going to do a little bit of statistics here as well, but when it comes to the need to work with numbers, that's not the main focus of this course. We are doing a little bit of numbers. You will get an exam, for instance, where there are some numbers involved. There are some tables, data you have to read out and interpret. But basically, this is not about statistics. It's about methodologies and how to scientifically. What do we mean when we test the hypothesis? Why do we do it? And some of these central knowledges. That's what we are focusing on here. And some of you might be there, some maybe aren't. That's the experience. So one of the core ideas with this course is to bring everybody up on a certain level when it comes to some of the terminologies that you use and some scientific thinking in general. Yes, there will be some examples of earlier exams and exam questions, for instance, in Blackboard. Probably if you dig deep, you will find them now. But I might add some more this year. So try to change a little bit on these things. It's not that the exam is only questions. Those example questions, but if you are able to answer them, you should also be able to answer the exam in a decent way. And the exam is pretty early in this course. I think this is the right date, but you have to check this yourself. The date I found on the course pages at NTNU was the 28th of November, meaning that this exam is in the very beginning of the exam period we have. So it's a relatively short semester. Did you find the same date, or have you checked? I think it should be correct. I think it's correct. So, yes? Okay, there isn't anything I can do with it, but tell them that they can slag it, follow the recording. It's probably better. So it will be a recording right afterwards available. There's little I can do with it. I'm just using this system we have. But thank you for following this, if you... Yeah, I didn't say that. It seems to be a pretty... Well, I don't know how many are here, but 30 or something. The number of students in this course is way higher, so there is a reason why people are following this online. I think we have some 160 students here now. So you are only a small part of this. So why do we think that it's important to have a course, a rather basic course like this in the scientific research process? Well, it is because compared to what you have had so far in your study life, probably, it depends on what study you have been following, there have been a focus on learning skills, etc. You have mainly taken your information from course books. That's the experience. While now, as you are also going to write a master's thesis, you have to gather more and more information from other sources. And you have to be critical when you read these sources and when you gather information, these databases, for instance. Because it is expected that a master's thesis has a level of science to it. Not all are doing science in the kind of narrow way that we use it when we talk, when I give examples here. But no matter what you are doing, you have to consume information and apply it in a theory chapter, for instance, in a master's thesis. So you have to justify, for instance, a problem statement with theory and not just by sound or common sense or whatever. And the information you base this on is something you have to be critical about. Good research. Is it written in a good way? Is it written in a good journal? Is it within the right theoretical context for your technical disciplines? These are things you have to apply. And you can also say that thinking in scientific terms, thinking about variables, thinking about hypotheses, problem statements, etc., is also a tool for critical thinking. It's a way to structure, for instance, a master's thesis or any other where you try to draw some conclusions in the end. As I say here, some of you might be there. Some of you might have gone to, could say, study programs before, where they had a focus on scientific thinking, or where you have had classes in science. At least I know that some of you have the more technical backgrounds. At least you have had some statistics. But the experience here is that having statistics usually isn't enough for this, because statistics mean you can calculate the regression analysis, but you don't know why you use it. So at least that's my experience. So we try to lift this a little bit. But anyway, some of you are there. Some of you have all this experience, and fine by me. But we think it's important to bring everybody up on a certain as a quick start for a master thesis. What do we mean by this? I say think in scientific terms. What do I mean by it? Well, world class isn't the ambition, of course. But that you actually, when you do investigate something, when you try to make a sound theoretical background for a problem statement, something you want to investigate, at least then you base this search and this the argumentation you use, you that on scientific principles, as well as being a master student also means that you should have a theoretical scientific competence so you can apply this in later scientific work. Making a good master thesis, for instance, qualifies you to do a PhD program. And to start a PhD program, you really should have a sound scientific base for what you do. And there are also some additional things that we will spend a little time on here. And that is the fact that you reflect on some of the other stuff as well. Ethical issues. What can I do? What can't I do? And what do I need to do in order to perform a certain type of study? There are legal issues. There are this GDPR stuff you have to consider when you do research. And of course, there are a number of practical stuff that we will talk about. Most of you won't be doing an experiment, although some of the examples that we give here are turning around or are evolving around you could say the pure scientific experiment. But anyway, you need to apply a scientific sound way of thinking. Anyway, I didn't say that. This would be a good chance. This is the course book that we are using. It's Lydia and Ormrod. It's called Practical Research. It's in its 12th edition, although the web pages of been notified that the web pages of the NTNU pages of the course says 11th version. I'm not sure how to change that. I don't have access to that. But the latest one is the 12th one. If you have an earlier version, you can probably live with it. So the main change that has happened in this version compared to the 11th version, for instance, is it's a much better focus on what we call qualitative methodologies that don't talk about numbers necessarily. So that's a small change in this book. But otherwise, the structure is pretty similar, and so you should be able to live with it. It's not major changes, as you probably have noticed when it comes to course books with a high number of editions. I guess there are economical reasons for doing that now. So it's basically the same text. So just now a few words about what we mean by research. What is it? Well, basically, it's not only to do experiments or to show numbers. It is to wonder about something. The main idea here is that you wonder about something. That is narrowed enough down so that you actually can answer the question or the topic that you are trying to approach. There is always a tendency on saving the world while you end up trying to solve something very, very small in an algorithm or whatever. And that's fine. That's the scientific process. But of course, it's also the more practical that has to do with doing research, getting the right people to answer your questions, getting the right people to take part in an experiment, getting data out in a way that's objective, at least where you know where the errors are. And it is appropriate data analysis. You can apply the number of statistical methods to apply to a problem is huge always. As you see, I'm going to use a statistical package called SPSS, which is one I use and which is used in a number of contexts, at least where people are involved. When we analyze data, people are part of the process or the data gathering. What you will see when I bring that package up is that the number of methods and the choices are enormous. So it's very easy to lose your way there. So finding correct ways to analyze data, that is also a very important thing here. So what we will do now in this course is to analyze data with some, could say, very basic generic methods, but there are, could be in the different disciplines, more specific ways to analyze data. There are journals who require special types of analysis, for instance. That's also part of this process. You wonder about something, but you have a very structured approach to answer the question that you set up in the beginning. And an important thing here in the end is to say that this should always be based on existing knowledge and existing theories. Very few of you will be in a position where you start from scratch. Reference lists are long because there is a reason for these reference lists belong in articles. Right? It is because a lot of work have been done on the topics you try to approach. Very little of what you do is new. But you have nuances to it, right? And that's the important thing here. Always have to base it on something. There's always something that exists out there. Yes, I know you say that Einstein in his work on relativity had very few references. But again, that was probably pretty new when it came out, right? there are examples, but in general, you won't be in an area where you have those situations. So when we say that, we can also say something about what isn't science. You say that doing things to become better yourself, reading up on a topic in order to be able to answer a problem, is usually not considered as scientific approach. It's necessary, of course, but that's not a central part of the scientific process. It's not a way to analyze data. Neither is usually literature search in itself, that you actually dig deep into a topic, try to investigate it. That isn't research. It's fundamentals for doing research. But it's not as such necessary for it's necessary for the scientific process and science itself. You could say there are examples where literature search can be scientific, where you try to do what's usually referred to as meta-analysis, where you in a structured way, try to see all the literature that are dealing with a certain topic, and you try to make numbers out of it. So many agree on this. So many didn't find results. So many found results that goes against the initial hypothesis. So some of you might be doing stuff that's similar to that. And in that way, literature search can be scientific in itself. And to be on the strict side, we also say that just transporting facts from one area to another one, if it doesn't bring in anything new, if you can't ask why a new situation is very different from the existing one, well, then it's neither that is scientific in a way. Okay, all of you won't be doing science necessarily. And some of you might have got into situations where you use other words for this. For instance, those of you who do study interaction design have been bombarded in earlier studies with the term, I don't know, in design thinking, you have to do some, what do you call it? Anyone? you have to have an investigation phase, right? An insight phase is what they call it. And of course, the idea here is that such an insight phase should be something more than read up on the topic. You might have, you should have some ways to analyze data. When you do interviews, for instance, how do you treat the data there? What do you do with the interview data that you gather? Do you write them down and make your own impressions, or do you have a structured approach to getting the important information out of what you read? It's the last I want you to do in a master's program. Maybe earlier on a bachelor's level, you weren't that much forced to do that. You were trying to find just status of information on a certain area. But what we want you to do here is to be more scientific about these things. Yeah? Affinity mapping, yeah. It can, because it is somewhat in the umbrella of qualitative methods. But you may also take it a step further and apply a qualitative method where you actually transcribe data, where you try to structure things actually. It could be in an automated way. So, in a way, affinity mapping is a qualitative method. Not necessarily, because it's a question of how you treat the interview data before you put it into these affinity diagrams. But it's a good thing. But it's also a good example of. Of a field that have made a number of new catchwords for existing structural ways of approaching things. So, yeah, I'm not supposed to be very negative about design thinking here, but it could be the emperor's new clothes when you look at it in some ways. There are many catchy words there. Of course, and it, we'll get back to it, because one of the central terms that we are going to approach is the general topic biases, is that can be either because you don't get the right people, that you draw the wrong conclusions, that that you don't get the responses from those to get the responses from, for instance, which leads to erroneous conclusions as well. So it's in that discussion. So being scientific, is it difficult? Does it need to be difficult? Aren't we natural scientists? Can't we just observe something and draw conclusions based on that in a pretty straightforward way? Well, I guess, but in ways we are not very good at this. Right? We are somewhat biased, and some of you might have seen these examples before. A human isn't really always a very good intuitive researcher. And we are certainly not very good as computers. We're not as rational as a computer. We tend to be biased towards things. We misinterpret. We don't use statistics in a natural way. And we tend to make a lot of the conclusions that we draw, the early conclusions that we get to, based on more or less intuition. We have to, because we are bombarded with so much information always. This is an example that's used now and then about the intuitive way to that we tend to apply when we try to draw a conclusion. It's a pretty obvious, it's an easy one, right? A bat and a ball together costs $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? That's the natural one, right? 10 cents, the ball. But it's not correct, right? Is it? What happens if you... In that case, the difference will be too big, won't it? The correct answer is something else. 5 cents. But the natural one is the one you came to. And that's okay, because now you already knew that this was a tricky question, so some of you got easy to this. Naturally, we would do this type of cognitive errors. Like 70-80% of us will do this, but then when we think about it, we see that to make the difference 10 cents only, to make the bat a whole dollar more costly than the ball, well, actually, you need a smaller difference there. To have, you need the to cost 10 cents more than the bat, yes, but in order to get a dollar difference, then you will have to. The bat will have to cost $1.05. So it's not an easy one, or it is an easy one when you interpret it afterwards, and when you apply a more thorough way of thinking about this. This comes from a book by Daniel Kahneman, together with Tversky. He came up with a best-selling book in the. He also got the Nobel Prize, not for the book, but earlier for his work. Actually, economics, he's a psychologist. Thinking Fast and Slow, where they make a distinction between what they called system one and system two. A system one and a system two way of thinking, where system one is the, you could say, the preferred system for humans. It's the system where we see something, we draw conclusions, or react based on intuitions, based on general heuristics, rules of the thumb. And it's usually a very unconscious process. We don't apply a low rational way of thinking about them. We just draw conclusions. And that's the example in this, the previous one, right? The natural thing to say is $1.10. Well, system two, then the preferred one, if we are to draw conclusions in science, we should take a step back and apply more slow, systematic, conscious, controlled methods instead of the natural human way of attacking this. So this is one of the arguments for why we need scientific methods. Right? Why can't we just observe something and draw conclusions? Well, it's because when we draw conclusions based on observations only, we tend to do mistakes, unfortunately. And I'll give you another example here. Because again, we are touching now the area of biases, erroneous, skewed conclusions that we make, and this is a pretty famous problem-solving task that has been done in different versions from the late 50s. It's called Wason's card selection task, and it is a pretty straightforward but very structured task. Can change some of the content, for instance, on the cards that we have here, because what we see here are then four cards. These cards all have a letter on one side and they have a number on the other side. And then we have a statement we want to investigate, right? We want to find the results here. And the statement is, if a card has a vokal på norsk, on one side, it has an even number on the other side. That's the statement. And what I want you to do now is to tell me which or what card do you need to turn over in order to determine if the rule is true or false. That's the task. And you can think this over in a break. So we do a 15 minutes break now and start 10 minutes past. Then we can end a little bit earlier as well. So then we'll go through this. And try not to discuss it with your friends now. Try to find the answer here. Which cards do you need to turn over in order to determine if the rule is true or false? So we'll start again 10 minutes past. Okay, let's start again. We'll try to finish a bit early, by the way, so don't worry if it's late. I forgot to mention one of the classes we have present here. There's something from someone from Applied Computer Science, for instance, which usually is a decent group. Yes, good. Sorry, I forgot to mention you. what are the correct answers? Anyone would like to try this? All four? Not. Well, it's a safe approach, but you should choose as few as possible. So another one on the back there. The A is not this one, right? Everybody. A and 4, let's try that one. How many of you agrees to A and 4? Almost half the class, or at least it started out with a number of arms. The other suggestion was just 4? K and 5? A and 5. Yes, because K would have been a bit of a surprise, right? On the back? Just. How would you argue for that? Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's right. But you need to do, actually you need over one more to test it, yes? It says, it's always a number on the other side. If it's a letter, it's a number on the other side. So it's one of the sides has a letter, one of the sides has a number. Yes? Okay. Yeah, it's an argument that many are using. Yes, it's a logic that is applied by many. And let me just cut to the answer here. What most of you show now is the expected argument. And it shows something we like to call a confirmation bias. We try to search for a confirmation of the statement that's there. While what we should do in order to test it is also to try to falsify it. Right? And there is one of these letters that would falsify the statement. And there are a couple of you have mentioned it. What would happen if there was a vowel on the 5? That would actually falsify the whole statement. Right? And that's something that's very hard for us to apply to these type of logics. We tend to try to approve something and to confirm it rather than to falsify things. This is one of the arguments why falsification also is a very central topic in a scientific approach to answering a question. Okay, let's go through them. The A is obvious, right? It says something about a vowel. If it has a vowel on one side, it has an even number on the other side. So the first one, if you turn that around, then you either approve it or disapprove it or falsify it, because that's the obvious one. It says something about that in the saying there, or in the statement. The K, what would happen if there was say an even number on the other side of the K? What would that tell us? Nothing at all. Because the statement doesn't say anything about it. It doesn't say anything about consonants. The four? Yes, it doesn't say. It could well have a consonant on the other side. Because it doesn't say that consonants can't have an even number. The statement doesn't say anything about that. I think actually some, I don't remember the numbers now, but initially, like 60-70% choose the A combined with the 4 when they have some time for this. But it is the wrong answer. So in order to disapprove it, of course, you need to turn the five around. Because if it happens to have a vowel on the other side, then it falsifies the statement. Hard logics. on an easy task. Most will do this mistake. And it's called confirmation bias. It's something we apply all the time. It's a Eurex, you could say. A rule of the thumb we use to when we gather knowledge. We form an initial hypothesis and we try to confirm it rather than falsify it. It's a normal human trait. I said it's a well-used task. It's a well-used task because it can be varied in many ways. And we see that when we put it on a more practical topic. We tend to do it much better. We tend to be much better at this. For instance, if we, because we are bad at this type of say, rational logics. If we, instead of vowels and consonants and odd numbers, put, for instance, statement saying that if you are under 18 years old, you drink non-alcoholic beverages in the bar. Because you're not allowed. Then you should put a social context that we're more used to on this task. And when you put, for instance, Coke and two numbers out there, then most of us will answer this correctly. So this is just an example of a task as well that allows us to do research. We apply a method where we know how things behave in a more rational setting, where we have to try to apply logic to it. And when we see that this is different in another context with different content, well, then we can use this to talk about or to discuss why is this case. For instance, it's just it's not important in this context, but it's an example. And I guess some of you were this. I don't know why I haven't changed this. It says AK-45 here. Did anyone notice that? It's Yeah, so there is someone are distracted with this always. Did anyone see it? It's the weapon, right? Russian, it's the Kalashnikov or whatever it's called, I think. Huh? AK-47, okay. But at least someone comments on this always. Okay, maybe I've changed it to 5 instead of 7. It could be. Okay, maybe it's the previous. Okay, when we look in different textbooks or search for what is science on the net, we tend to see a number of lists that have something in common. They may have different words in there. There may be different different levels of granularity, different numbers of points in lists like this. I've just brought in a few of them here. Just look at this one, for instance, because it also gives some idea about a very central part of the scientific process, namely that it's somewhat recursive. It always align back a feedback in the system. It's a circular process. It's not a linear process as such, because you always research on others' work. You never start from scratch. And you always try to contribute something for others. So this is a very common thing that you will encounter when you see these types of lists. The scientific process is a circular process. It's a never-ending process. And it should always be based on others' theory. And then you have another number of other, it's a good important points here. It should be replicable. So you should always do research in a way and describe research in a way to allow for others to test out the same as you tested out. So things should be described in enough detail for others to be able to repeat your study. You should always also have the option to draw some lines further on, that you try to generalize a little bit from your research. You try to see how does it apply to other contexts. Did you try to speculate a little bit on this? It should be logical and theory-based. It should be possible to do. It should, ideally, and then we get back to this circular quality, it should generate some new questions for us. And then there are different versions of this. For instance, this list I'm taking up here has that a lot of people want to discuss. And the idea that science always should be political and show social responsibility. Ethical standpoint, I think it's a good thing to have there. But again, research isn't only one thing, as we'll get back to. It is, of course, debatable, but at least in a context, you should say this. Hopefully, at least you should be aware that scientific conclusions might have consequences in the society and where the research don't always stand on its sound, good legs, and all conclusions shouldn't necessarily be published even if you find something. Because there are consequences of what you do in research. But we'll get back to some of the examples there later when we talk about ethics. So we'll talk about it later. So there are many of these. Some are more graphical. Always try to point out this circular or recursive or whatever you would call it, quality of research. So, we are talking about an ideal process now where we stand in our white coat, laboratory coats and try to do research and comes up with conclusions. That's not what most of you will do. Some of you will, for instance, have some cool ideas about something. You want to make a cool product. You want to make a new cool algorithm. You want to make the app that kills all the apps or whatever. Can that be scientific? Just to make something? I would say it can be, but you have to put it in a context. That's the point here. So even though you, even if you want to make or develop a new algorithm, or just to to make a new program and try to sell that, to make something that solves something that haven't been solved before, you can do that in a scientific way, but you have to put it into some kind of a context. You have to reflect, for instance, why did you make it? What was the reason I made this? Have others tried to make it before and not succeeded? Why not? What is it with my new approach? And that can maybe generate some new ideas. What is it with my new approach that hopefully solves the problem much better than the other ones did it? Does it always work? You could test that out. Are there instances where it doesn't work? Why is that? What needs to be improved for it to work in those contexts under other circumstances than I ideally test it to work in? There is a, we have a, I think a recording of a previous previous master thesis in the Blackboard page under the example master thesis, I think the recording is called. It was an Italian student of mine a few years ago who were working with, it was trying to figure out a way to compensate for varying light when he measured pupil diameter, or pupil dilation, because pupil dilation is also a cognitive measure of being under high mental workload. But the pupil reacts mostly to light, so you have to take out the light in the equation. So what he did was, of course, was to use an eye tracker, a portable eye tracker, and put some sensors to try to take out the effect of light. But it didn't always work. It worked in some laboratory contexts. It didn't in other contexts, so we had to add point of gaze and other stuff to it for it to work better. But that was typically something that started out with an idea of a product. I want to work with this eye tracker. But so it was a cool thing. It has shown to work in some contexts later. We're still doing research using this. But it was a very good type of project that made these fancy new things. So the point here is, when you do something like this, reflect on it. Then it can be a good thing anyway. Then it can be scientific. Reflect on it in a scientific way. Then it can be good. A lot of the examples that you will encounter in the recordings, and when we do this as when you do this in groups, for instance, when you do a project here, has to do with a very limited part of science. It's very much focused on the classical experiment. I put up a hypothesis. I set up an experiment to gather data, numbers, and I try to falsify a null hypothesis that has to do with the effect of what I study. This is called null hypothesis hypothesis testing. So it's we'll get back to what this is in practical terms. And this is a very limited, of course, approach when it comes to science. But I've chosen to do it in this course anyway because it allows us to talk about the central terminologies. We talk about hypotheses, we can talk about biases, we can talk about experimental designs, We can do hypothesis testing, for instance. We can talk about reliability and validity, which are other central topics that can be very clearly explained within the context of an experiment. But it's important to remember that I guess most research today is not based on pure quantitative experimental approaches. It's only part of what we call science. It can be many other things. One such distinction can be, for instance, between experimental and non-experimental methods. We could see that things like descriptive methods, that you just describe what a population is like, that you describe a phenomena and its occurrence. It can be historical research, where you look into databases or other sources to try to figure out how things have developed. Are we more aggressive now than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, as a result of the media situation? Is the do we have... Are we more in our, silos now than we were a few years ago as a result of more social media usage? Those are things that it's not experimental. They can even bring up numbers. But they have this non-experimental approach. They describe something and how it has developed. We have correlational research, where we just look at the relationship between variables. And we can have these types of qualitative research that aims to get insight more than actual numbers on things, where we want to investigate and understand the phenomena rather than describe it as numbers or test the hypothesis. And of course, we have the experimental methods. And the focus we have in this course is the experimental method. And it is also, what we could call the very empirical type of approach to it. But in empirical research, and empirical means we gather data, usually in numbers. There we have this clear hypothesis testing. Also usually very reductional. It tries to cut things down into very small problems that we actually can answer. So it's no confusion that we actually are answering the right question. And it's theory-based. It's in a context where we have a lot of theory to justify what we do. So the gray box here is the box where most of my examples are. But there are many other ways of doing research. We could take one, for instance, the advocacy thing, for instance, where we have like what we tend to call action research, where the researcher is part of this situation. I know that this type of action research is, for instance, used in the more organizational approaches in information security, where people who work in an organization try to improve, for instance, safety culture in using certain methods, but where the researcher is it, and he wants to change things. He wants things to improve. So she is part of the process herself. This is typically also, can also be very, you could say, politically biased research, where you have ideals. You want to reduce exploitation of children, for instance. So you have a political or ethical or goal doing this as well. And when you do this, of course, you you're not as objective as the ideal is in research. But it still can be research, right? Because you say what you do. You're open with it. Discuss it. People can argue against you and your methods. So, and this is also considered good research. It can very well be good research. As well as the more constructivist approach where maybe you are going into an area where there aren't much theory. The effects of social media these days, for instance, well, now there is shelf after shelf literature on this. But some years ago, of course, it wasn't. And then you have maybe had to develop theories for why do we think social media has this tendency to polarize opinions more than the earlier information exchange we had in society. Maybe you didn't know, or you had an idea that this was the case, but through interviews, through protocols, through analysis of how discussions take place, you develop new theories. And these theories may be later be tested in different ways in an empirical context. But you have to understand the phenomena in order for this to work. Another major, because I chasm many ways in the scientific approach, has been the discussion between people who do qualitative research and who do quantitative research. 10 or 20 years ago, quantitative research was considered the other only objective way to do research. I'm taking this far now. It's not 20 years, right? It's a continuous thing. But in many contexts, quantitative, where you get a number, were considered to be the only approach to science and good approach to science. Everything else was too biased, too difficult, too interpretative. Usually it wasn't. In psychology, you will find extremely focused types of studies where people perform controlled tasks, where everything else is taken out of the context. They are artificial as hell. but they are clear-cut number focused, right? That's very qualitative, very, very quantitative. But when you try to build a theory, you don't necessarily understand the phenomena when you do that. So if it is a phenomena that you don't really know how will work, if you haven't investigated it enough, then you actually can't do then quantitative approaches where you gather numbers and try to falsify a hypothesis. Isn't the way to go, because you don't know how to formulate a good hypothesis. So in those contexts, you need a qualitative approach where you rather describe and understand the phenomena than try to explain it with underneath it. So you don't get numbers in that sense, but you understand the problem. And you get new ideas because you can explore and interpret things in space. Everything is scientific. Yes, everything is scientific if you approach it the right way. If you show your uncertainties, for instance, if you describe your methodology so that it can be falsified by others in discussions. We'll get back to some of these discussions. What one needs to be aware of then, when you do qualitative approach, is that it's more than quantitative approaches. Vulnerable to biases, because there is always an element of the researcher in there. It's a researcher who reads, for instance, interviews and tries to interpret what did the person I interviewed actually mean when he said this. Why should I categorize this as falling into the category of, let's say, being critical to the society or whatever, if I do something like that. You try when you use qualitative methods to categorize opinions or statements in different groups. But there is always a researcher who needs to do this. And that, of course, that makes us vulnerable to biases. We are humans. We do the mistakes we tend to do. We need to be aware of, for instance, the confirmation bias. We tend to find what we search for and not all the rest. So, but still can be scientific. There are ways to approach this. And as I said, one of the major changes in this edition of the book is that it has a lot more focus on also qualitative methods. So I just say this to make it clear that I won't classify quantitative approaches before qualitative approaches when it comes to doing science. They're both valid. Okay, that was a good time to lose the signal, which made me a bit nervous in the beginning before the lecture as well, because this happened. Oh, it's back. Good. I think we can just... wrap it up, but it is very much the nature of your research question, the topic, the area where you're doing research, that shows you the direction, that helps you to choose methods. It's not everything that is possible to test out in a quantitative way that will give you numbers in the end. Some questions needs to be explored more extensively. Also be some time issues. It takes a lot of time to do very controlled research, because it tends to be that quantitative, at least the experimental approach, is extremely reductionistic in its approach. It tries to cut down questions into extremely small questions and answer the small questions. So in order to answer a large topic in a quantitative way, you usually have to do many experiments to analyze things in different ways. While you can do a lot with quantitative research, only doing some interviews, for instance, on asking the right people, asking experts on an area, asking the users, asking different groups. So this very much dictates the method that you can use. And it's also some personal things involved here. If you're not talking to people, interviewing them, then maybe then you need to use other methods. That's valid. It's there is not only one approach to things. So there are different different question asks for different methodologies, even though we are focusing very much on the experimental, empirical, quantitative way of doing experiments in this course and in the examples that I use in this course. There is a lecture on qualitative methods now. That's in the end of the list of the recordings. Okay. Quarter 10 to 6, it's late. I found it a bit better than 8:15 anyway. I'm not sure if everybody agrees. I'm in that group. The reason we have to do it like this is the number of different study programs involved, and some have courses over whole days, etc. So this is the only time slots we could find. But anyway, it's not a lot of meetings, it's a lot of recordings, so hopefully that's okay. By the way, sorry for having to postpone the start here. I actually managed to get my portion of the corona thing a couple of weeks ago, so I couldn't be here. But hopefully I've started now. So next time we will, in for 2 weeks time, we will go into some central terminologies. I will start you up with the first assignment, and we will also talk a little bit about the project next time. Yes? It is now 4:15 to 6. And that's the time slot. We have this time slot now for these meetings. Mm. This